Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm honored to be a part of the Bach Festival this year and to share a stage with these fine musicians. If you are here this week sharing in the concerts at noon or the concerts in the evening, then I think you'll agree with me that we were privileged to hear heavenly sounds. Our week, though, was interrupted. But I think I can call nothing less than a hellish tragedy. It's in the context of this latest tragedy that I can't help but cringe at the story of Jesus that we heard earlier this morning. Let me explain. I'm concerned that misinterpretations of this story will contribute to Christians and others believing that by simply speaking words of peace, that we can make it so. The passage we read portrays Jesus in a boat, in the midst of a storm. The winds are howling, the waves are tossing the boat to and fro, and after Jesus is awoken and his disciples plead with him, he speaks to the wind, "Peace, be still." And the winds calm, and the storm ceases to rage. Now, I love this story. It's an iconic story. It's an image that has been very helpful to me and many others as we face the storms that rage throughout our lives. And I think it would be incredible. Imagine if we could, by speaking words, peace, peace, make it so. Like Oprah, we could run around the world from city and neighborhood, countryside to countryside, proclaiming, "You get some peace, and you get some peace, and you get some peace." Unfortunately, as thousands of people have protested vigilante violence and police brutality against black and brown bodies in America, too many people over the last 3 years have acted as though calling for peaceful protests will heal the racial wounds in this nation. Each time protesters gather, other people perched in powerful positions or perhaps sitting comfortably at home in their easy chairs demand that the protesters remain peaceful or engaged in what they call peaceful protest. You can be sure as the Confederate flag flies high over the state of South Carolina this morning, that there will be people who will gather to protest that flag and all that it represents. It is a flag of a secessionist government that wanted to assert its right to hold black bodies in chains. And that flag flies today tall and proud, as it did Wednesday evening, and then on through Thursday morning while the rest of us mourned. And as the nation's flag flew at half-mast and the state's flag as well, after a white terrorist who acted on behalf of what that flag represented, gunned down Ethel Lance and Cynthia Hurd, Susie Jackson, Myra Thompson, Tawanza Sanders, Reverend Daniel Simmons, Reverend Sharon Singleton, Reverend DePayne Middleton Doctor, and the state senator, Reverend Clementa Pinckney. 9 African Americans at a Bible study. You see, there are people who still believe that they are at war against racial equality. And that flag, you should know, was placed on the state capitol in 1962 in the midst of the civil rights movement. It was a proverbial middle finger to all that the civil rights movement represented. And I think that flag should signal to the rest of us that even if we are not at war, we are certainly not at peace, so long as state legislatures protect symbols such as these through their constitutions. Still, there will be those who will hear of the protesters, the marchers, the rioters, and they will shout to them, "Peace, be still," because they believe that somehow peace has been disturbed by such people. I heard another example of this just a few weeks ago. Perhaps you're familiar with this as well. On June 5th, a video surfaced on social media of police officers diving at and chasing and brutalizing African-American teenagers at a pool party in McKinney, Texas. You've likely seen the video or heard about the situation. Dozens of black and white people were gathered together, standing on sidewalks of a suburban neighborhood in swimsuits and towels. And while it was clear that there were many different types of people there, frenzied police officers were only yelling at and chasing the black children. At one point, an officer throws a young girl to the ground and then proceeds to press his knee into her back, cuffing her hands behind her back, only to follow up by pulling out his gun and chasing two black boys away from the scene. Days later, June 8th, hundreds of people marched on McKinney, Texas. They were black and white, brown and red and yellow as well. This time, the police were escorting the protesters to a pool. While they marched, they chanted, "We are here. We are here. Let's go swimming. Let's go swimming." And then, in a moment that I can only describe as bringing chills to me, a chorus sang out, "A change is gonna come." They called the march the McKinney Rally for Accountability. At the conclusion of the rally, a man asked them to give a round of applause to themselves for keeping the rally peaceful in the spirit of Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. As one news source described it, McKinney is not Ferguson. Protesters from in and around McKinney and beyond gathered over the past week to react in solidarity to events that transpired on June 5th. Aside from a few shouting matches and brief scuffles, they did so peacefully. But I have a problem with this description of what happened that day. When people gather to protest, to rally, to hold vigils, they do so because there is no peace. My friends, we are not at peace. Since 2012, when George Zimmerman shot and killed unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin, many American citizens awakened to the terrible reality that black and brown lives are too often targets for vigilante violence and police misconduct. Black and brown people, of course, have known this for quite some time. It's difficult to be black or brown and not know this reality. But in white suburban America, where officer-friendly visit school assemblies, police officers give lost travelers directions or help fix flat tires, learning that a black man is 21 times more likely to be shot and killed in an encounter with a police officer than his white counterparts, has been difficult for white suburban America to process. You see, data like this threatens the illusion of peace so necessary to the myth of the American suburban dream. In suburbia, peace is portrayed in pristine lawns, dog parks, and Princess Fiona parties. In suburbia, peace is celebrated in the silence of families who agree to the unspoken rule that sin is found in speaking too loudly of sexuality and in speaking too often of the ongoing saga of racial inequality in this nation. And in such places, the voices of black people like Martin Luther King Jr. get co-opted to endorse a peace where there is no peace. A peace that perpetuates injustice rather than challenges an unjust system and structure that privileges the powerful over the powerless. A peace that empowers the privileged few over the mass of people who live perpetually with their backs against the wall. Here in the homogeneous neighborhoods of the powerful and privileged, an uninformed wish becomes a social reality before factual information can lend solid design to its infrastructure. Now, perhaps you've heard of the difference between what one theologian calls isness and oughtness. If you haven't heard, I'll explain it to you. This is the recognition that there is a difference between the way life is and the way it ought to be. I also want to suggest this morning that there is an important need to distinguish isness from wishness. That is the difference between America as it is, and America as we wish it would be. Many of us, middle to middle upper class suburbanites, live in wishness. Our neighborhoods are make-believe. It's not to say that we don't experience difficulties, because of course we do. We experience sickness and tragedy, disappointment, hardship, and anxieties. In fact, I think our lives are filled with anxieties over losing all that we believe that we own or that we believe that we have earned. But most days in our neighborhoods, we pretend that death, disease, divorce, disaster, disappointment, and the full range of human experience cannot penetrate our white picket fences so long as we refuse to talk about it. That is until we're forced to. When our lives are interrupted by images of angry black people protesting, thousands of fed-up urbanites marching in streets, or dozens of angry, impoverished young people burning down a pharmacy, we are forced to deal with realities that we have attempted to insulate ourselves from through our suburban silence and wishing. In other words, we have systemized denial, and then we have made every effort to live there. This, my friends, is not peace. It's only peace if we believe that peace is the absence of conflict. But some 50 years ago, we learned the lesson from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. that peace is not merely the absence of conflict, but it is the presence of justice. Where there is no justice, there is no peace. No justice, no peace. This is the cry of the protesters in Ferguson, marchers in New York City, and revolutionaries in Baltimore. For those of us who just woke up to these cities and the ongoing problems between the police and black and brown bodies, we might be troubled by the interruptions their voices have brought to our dinner tables, our water coolers, and our Facebook pages. But that is our problem, not theirs. No justice, no peace. That is not a threat as much as it is a statement of reality. I think what many of us have missed in our Facebook debates, our roundtable discussions, and our water cooler gossip is that this is true. This is what many people have missed as they have called for peaceful protests. You see, it is this type of problematic plea for peaceful protest that the Hebrew prophet Jeremiah rebuked when he said, "They have healed the brokenness of my people superficially, saying, 'Peace, peace,' but there is no peace." What exactly is a call for a peaceful protest other than a commitment to maintaining the status quo? What is a call for a peaceful protest other than wishful thinking that waiting without disruptions will solve problems that have persisted for decades? Let me say this frankly. Protests are meant to disturb the facade of peace that whitewashes the tragedies of oppression. In the midst of these protests, many of us will recall the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. in the civil rights movement's nonviolent marches and protests. But I fear that in our romanticizing of the past, we will fail to remember that Martin Luther King may have written his most important and well-known letter while sitting in a cell in a Birmingham jail. And why was he there, you might ask? For nothing other than disturbing the peace. You see, I think we've confused nonviolence for being peaceful. In the letter, he challenged white moderate Christians to choose between the status quo and disturbing the peace. Let me read his words. Whenever the early Christians entered a town, the people in power became disturbed and immediately sought to convict the Christians for being disturbers of the peace and outside agitators. Things are different now. So often the contemporary church is a weak, ineffectual voice with an uncertain sound. So often it is an arch defender of the status quo. Far from being disturbed by the presence of the church, the power structure of the average community is consoled by the church's silent and often even vocal sanction of things as they are. Peace, as we know, means completeness, prosperity, welfare, wholeness, well-being, justice. I ask this morning, how can one disturb something that does not exist? In Ferguson, Missouri, a formerly white suburb, now a racially segregated neighborhood with high poverty and unemployment, poor student achievement in predominantly black schools, oppressive policing, abandoned homes, and community powerlessness, there has been no peace for years. In New York City, where stop and frisk laws authorize the harassment of black and brown young people in the name of broken window policing, there has been no peace for years. In Baltimore, where the city has given over $5.7 million in settlements for police misconduct against black people like a 12-year-old bike rider, a pregnant woman, and a senior citizen, peace has been absent for years because there has been no justice. No justice, no peace. And this isn't simply about places like Baltimore. In the spirit of Ubuntu, the African philosophy that says, I can't be what I need to be until you are who you need to be, Dr. King said that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. To put it plainly, we are not at peace in America. So if we can't simply say peace and wish it be so, what can we do? Well, if we are to call ourselves Christians or claim to be imitators of Christ or peacemakers, then we must better understand that Jesus did more than quiet the winds and calm the storm. Our affluent interpretations of this story obfuscate the very things we should learn from Jesus. Because of our affluence, we are often disconnected from the lives of those we claim to serve, and I think far too often we read our disconnect into this story. See, Jesus did two things. First, Jesus got into the boat with his disciples so that when the strong winds and the storms struck, he was with them. Yes, indeed, he spoke peace, and the winds subsided. But he didn't do so from afar. He made their trouble his trouble. And secondly, when he addressed the storm, his actions protected the people so that he can empower them to do greater things in the future. My point is this: if our pleas for peace are made from afar, from places of comfort and without the experience of the devastating effects of the storm, then we are not proclaiming a Christ-like peace. Moreover, if our pleas for peaceful protest do more to pacify the powerful than they do to protect and empower the powerless, then we aren't proclaiming the peace of Christ. We are simply making it more possible for the powerful to keep the powerless in their place. So you might wonder, if it's not Christ-like to plead for peaceful protests, when I'm disturbed by the news of a riot I hear in a city far away, then David, what would you have me do? What would you have me say? Well, if we agree with Martin Luther King Jr. this morning, who defined a riot as the voice of the unheard, then perhaps we should say nothing. Perhaps we might start building peace by listening. When we see protests and riots, there is no peace. And when there is no peace, we cannot callously criticize people oppressed by injustice. When there is no peace, we must study the injustices that oppress the people. When there is no peace, we cannot wait for someone else to stand up for justice. When there is no peace, we must join in solidarity with those who suffer. When there is no peace, we cannot simply preach peace with our lips. When there is no peace, we must build the foundations for peace with our very lives. When there is no peace, we cannot make our goal abstract and incomprehensible by trying to change the world. When there is no peace, we must commit ourselves locally that we might begin to change our part of the world. In closing, what I hope we learned from McKinney, Texas, is that we need not travel to the other side of the world to find places in need of peace, despite our best wishes. We need peace on our suburban streets as much as we need peace in the Middle East. Where racial inequalities and economic disparities thrive, there can be no peace. And in a nation where the flag of rebels who fought to abuse black bodies still waves, after descendants of those black bodies lay lifeless on the floor of an African Methodist Episcopal church, because the spirit of the Southern lost cause, the spirit of the Confederacy, possessed a man to slay them, there can be no peace. Those of us who desire to see peace must agree together this morning to end our complicity with oppression through our silent subservience to the seduction of racially, economically, and sexually segregated suburbias. We must instead opt to find ways to be in solidarity with the poor, the oppressed, and the disempowered people in our own neighborhoods, in our own cities, in our own countrysides. The only silence we should commit to is refusing to condemn the protests of people with whom we have no relationship. It's time that we refuse to comply with white supremacist proclamations of peace when there is no peace. And it's time that we teach our children how to dismantle the systems and structures that make racism possible, so that then we can begin to build new systems and structures through which justice can flow like mighty waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Let us pray. We are mindful this morning of conflict and strife around the world. We are mindful this morning of conflict and strife in our nation. We are mindful this morning of conflict and strife in our communities. We are mindful this morning of conflict and strife in our families. We are mindful this morning of conflict and strife in our own hearts. And so we pray for peace this morning. Not just with our lips, but with our lives. May we be instruments of peace that do more than speak words and wish for conflicts to end. May our bodies be instruments that contribute to building just structures and systems, just community structures and just family systems through which peace can thrive and be fulfilled. And may we have courage to challenge racism in our homes, our workplaces, and neighborhoods, so that we may become the people we have been waiting for, so that the hope of that old Methodist hymn can be realized. Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me. Amen.